I had my first CS1 lecture in this lecture theatre in 1975, and I think I gave my last lecture to CS1 in this lecture theatre in 1975. And I managed to get through my whole career without using PowerPoint, and it was Blackboard to the end. So there are no slides today.
No shock either.
So this is really a kind of student on the streets overview who then evolved to be the final head of the computer science department. I had the pleasure of leading it into destruction, as it were, or blending into informatics. And then I got out about 5 years ago. So it took a long time and was unexpected. So I suppose the first thing to say is I didn't actually come here to do computer science, so I came here to do maths. And luckily, a fortunate event happened to me when I turned up for my first CS1 tutorial, because who should be my tutor but Sydney. And I think it's fair to say that changed the rest of my life from the word go. Funnily enough, as my maths tutor, I had someone called Professor Edge, who was rather mysterious because he was clearly extremely old and didn't appear in any staff list, so we didn't quite know who he was. And discovered he was a retired emeritus professor of geometry, in fact. And he came in to do one tutorial a week to keep his hand in, etc. And I suppose what taught me the difference between the maths department and computer science was I never knew him as anything else but Professor Edge. Maybe his first name was Professor, whereas in computer science, I never knew who Professor Michelson was. We were kind of formal. We called him Sydney. We hadn't got to the Sid stage at that point. And he got me started. I was telling Peter Robertson this story the other night. We were in a tutorial room upstairs with Sid. And for the first couple of weeks, he was kind of being a good tutor. We were learning IMP. I was kind of unusual in those days because I'd spent several years programming before that, so it wasn't very interesting. And Sid was teaching us how to declare integers and things like that, and so call them IJK, then L if you got stuck. Next door through a glass door was Peter Robertson, who was addressing the class. And for some reason, Peter was a bit loud, and you could hear him through the wall. And in tutorial three, Sid said, "If that guy next door is going to talk all tutorial, so shall I." And for the rest of the term, the rest of the year, he never talked about CS1. He told us what he was doing. He was doing his text analysis, Greek text analysis, and his biblical analysis at the time. And he told us about EMAS, et cetera. And he told us how he'd run out of virtual memory on EMAS. So Sid went over that 32 megabyte limit, which seemed outrageous at the time. And so by the end of the year, aided and abetted by my computer science director of studies, Alec White, I switched path. And CS1, the actual material wasn't very interesting to me because I knew how to program already. And it was really CS2 that opened my eyes, because there I had the pleasure of banging into Hamish, who taught us, quote, software, John Gray, who, quote, hardware, and Robin Milner, who was a theory guy. So I suppose I was always secretly envious of Hamish, actually, because he wrote code that none of the rest of us could write, and no one else could understand. And these days, it would be a bad thing to say, no one can understand your code, and there's no reuse. But I think we were all secretly envious that his code was half the size of anyone else's, and he set assignments, and you couldn't get to a sample solution. And I think the thing I had most fun with was on the PDP-9. It was homebrew, and the idea was to write device drivers for the peripherals. And the intention was you just did the paper tape reader and punch and maybe the printer. But it had a really fiendish card reader attached to it. The card reader, you get an interrupt on the first column, and then you had to work fast. You could only do about three instructions per column to capture this 12-bit pattern, which didn't come in as a 12-bit pattern, if I remember. And I recall the exercise was not to program the card reader, but I had a very happy Easter vacation in the machine halls playing around with that, which got me into the machine halls atmosphere, as it were. Meanwhile, John Gray, who was later to affect my life dramatically and directly lead to my departure from Edinburgh, in fact, was being John Gray. I was never very interested in hardware, but John's enthusiasm kind of lasts to the bitter end. And the old joke was John would hold his tutorial at the airport between flights and come in. And then Robin Milner, I was a sort of lapsed mathematician by then, but it kind of taught me that, hey, maybe one can join the dots here, and theoretical computer science can be good for a mathematical type like myself, and that kind of launched the general broad direction of what I was up to. But I had my real big break at the end of my second year when I got a summer job, and such was the closeness in those days. Somehow it was dual managed both in the computer science department and the ERCC. And this was the ERTE project, which was the Edinburgh Remote Terminal Emulator, which basically a PDP-11 sat in the machine halls pretending to be a TCP with lots of users attached. And it just fired scripts into EMAS in order to do performance and benchmarking, which, as Nick has just told us, was extremely important. And I suppose I can come clean now to Alec White and Colin Adams and Scott Curry, who are my employers. I wasn't actually very interested in it as an exercise, but it gave me two things. First of all, I got an ERCC account, ERCC 58, and in those days, as I recall, it was Roderick MacLeod. Undergraduates had a U as a fourth character in their username, and that meant you couldn't do things. So for the rest of my undergraduate career, I stuck with ERCC 58. And I remember Andrew McKendrick trying to get it off me as an undergraduate. And I was insisting I was still finishing the ERTE project. But really, that was my start in networking, which became my mainstream thing, because the ERTE stuff ran on top, but it got me interested in the act of connecting to the network, which was then RCONet, and it ran an operating system written by Brian Gilmore here in the front row. So, as usual, it was a homebrew operating system. And I remember at the time there was one RK05 dispatch sitting on a shelf beside it marked Unix. And no one quite knew what it was, except it had a game called Hunt the Wumpus on it. The only thing that Unix was ever used for, because we had our own operating system, was to play Hunt the Wumpus. When you got...
Don't forget the adventure program.
Yes, we had several versions of the adventure program.
On that system.
Yes. So, at the time, the computer science department was too friendly. The model's meant to be that students are scared of stuff and in awe of the stuff, but somehow it wasn't like that in CS. The people we were in awe with was the ERCC staff, who were a bit scary, of course. And doing networking then, of course, all of the protocols were home designed and the switches were built. And the basic networking protocol, which would roughly correspond to what is now IP, I suppose, was called NSI, the Node Standard Interface. And at that time, there was the Node, which was a Mod 1 computer, which John Butler involved. And in the protocol, there were various frame types, one of which was called the NIF, the Network Information Function. And what I knew was from the PDP-11, if you ever received a NIF, the node was about to crash. It was a kind of death throw. And then you'd have to creep along apologetically and explain to the ERCC people that something went wrong here, and then Glasgow would be cut off, and disasters like that. So that was my kind of early days. And then seeing Nick and Jeff here, in fact, took me back to CS3, because the entire third term, which was only 4 weeks in CS3, was taken up by Jeff and Nick doing this architecture seminar, which shock horror students were meant to read papers and things. And then we had these two-hour discussions every morning about the papers. And most people in class were really scared about it because it was Nick and Jeff. And they asked hard questions and made you think. And it was very dangerous. But then, funnily enough, in my fourth year, I got to do a project. And at that time, the RSA crypto system had just been invented the year before. And already having a bit of an inkling towards theory, Les Valiant, who was mentioned early. And Les was a very elusive character in the computer science department, but in fact, an utterly brilliant man who invented all sorts of completely way out theoretical concepts and has been at Harvard since 1982. So he put up a CS4 project, and this looked like a perfect blend of theory and practice, because what I had to do was to implement RSA, which was this brand new wacky algorithm, but on the 2900 using efficient machine code, etc. So how was I going to find out about EMAS 2900 machine code? Well, someone told me, Peter Stevens, who I can see at the back, is the man to see. So I went along rather nervously, because we were all scared of some ERCC people then, and said, I wondered if you could give me some help with EMAS 2900 machine code. So I remember Peter had a crowded office. He just reached over and passed this listing, which was actually the supervisor of EMAS 2900, and he said, you'll find some machine code in there. And that was my tutorial on 2900 machine codes. So I think the first Edinburgh implementation of RSA was written in IMP with copious inline machine code to do naughty things with double precision integers on the 2900. And the beauty was you could sit in the machine halls and watch on the lights on the 2900 when it was running the crypto stuff. The lights just went solid, and you knew you were getting somewhere. So that was how I got into the sort of joyful life that was Edinburgh Computer Science around the machine halls. In those days, Nick practiced sort of engineering by walking about, since his policy was to walk around and just ask people what they were doing and then make perceptive comments about it. However, I got to that point where you have to graduate, and I was liking it so much it seemed obvious to stay on to do a PhD. And this kind of gets me to the nub of so what emerged in later life, and I think it's the theme of the conference. At that time, the kind of discussions we had was, is there such a thing as computer systems research? And we kind of decided, no. So the theoreticians do research and write papers about it, because you have to write papers, because people have to read it and you can't do it. What we're about is building things and people using things. And I think that was very much the whole atmosphere that I grew up in the department, and seemed completely natural that it was about, you got the satisfaction of producing things, everything was homegrown, you controlled it, and people used it and then complained about it, so you tweaked it. So I ended up as this kind of bipolar personality, in fact. So I signed up with Les Valiant to do complexity theory topic as my PhD activity, while meanwhile having this very practical networking activity. By that time, the ERTE machine, I think the original performance evaluation had been forgotten. It turned into this machine bridging the gap between the world of the interdatas and the world of EMAS, etc. And if you read Noddy Goes to the Machine Halls, there's this gruesome instructions on how to crank out the PDP-11 and these obscure commands, etc., to get through. And that was the first kind of connection from the department own network into computer science. And then the VAX arrived, and I remember within weeks or less, Peter had an IMP compiler working. So needless to say, the first thing to do was to move EMAS to the VAX. So for a short summer, Gordon Hughes, who's somewhere, and I worked with David Rees, and the idea was to do EMACS with an X, which was EMAS for VAX, which was a nice summer project, but didn't actually, for once and the first time, I think a proprietary operating system got through the net, and maybe that was the beginning of the end, so to speak, for the Edinburgh thing, and VMS triumphed, and Emacs was a sort of fun project for the summer, etc. And from then on, it was all networking stuff for me, and at the time, there was a story, it would take approximately a year to connect a new host to RCONet or EdNet had to become, but in a productive Easter vacation with Paul McClellan, we managed through various feats to get VAX connected directly to the RCONet, etc., involving an obscure board called the DQS11 board, which was intended for PDP11s, but not VAXs. And whenever you started this board up, it just crashed the VAX. But it turned out by patching just one location in an interrupt vector, it was silent. And then for the next 5 or 6 years, it ran quite happily as a connection to the outside world. So there I was doing this practical networking on the side while notionally doing my PhD work, which was completely separate, etc. And then I got the invitation from Peter Schofield to join the staff, which seemed like a good deal because it was double the money. And he said, you'll only have to give 9 lectures and that's it. And I was billed as the man who could bridge theory and practice. The only trouble was I was kind of building the piers on both sides and not actually doing the bridge at that point. So I suppose the tragic thing about all the networking side in particular I was involved in was nothing was ever written up about it or published. And in retrospect, just a lot of the stuff we're talking today. There could have been so much more, and so much more message got out about the whole activity in Edinburgh. And someone like myself, you know, this embarrassing CV gap in your job history kind of thing, it's like an embarrassing publications gap where you have to explain, oh, during that time I had great fun doing things that people used and not writing about it, etc. So eventually, I did get one publication out of the networking work, which bizarrely was a sort of pseudo-theory paper. Because one night, we had a colleague, Brian Thompson, who'd come from Manchester, and he ran the Doctor Who fan club, which was an early email fan club. And what happened was people sent in email messages to the fan club, i.e. Brian Thompson, who then fanned them out to all the other members. And one night, there was big traffic on the Doctor Who fan club. And when I came in, this sort of 10 process VAX networking system was completely deadlocked. So being a good systems person, I just fixed it the next day. Then 2 years later, used as an example of modeling in CCS, which Jeff was mentioning, and this kind of took off. So eventually the only publication related to networking was this. The paper claimed the deadlock occurred, so we modeled it in CCS, we identified the problem, then we fixed the software, whereas in fact, this being Edinburgh, we'd fixed the software 2 years earlier and then analyzed it 2 years later, etc. So I think that's my only publication from the systems work. So sadly, of course, Unix did rise and TCP IP came in and George Ross took over that side on the back, so I can retard from active networking service, as it were, but John Gray, who I said I'd come back to, was the catalyst in my life, because in 1989, he told me about the field programmable Gatorade, which was then his current enthusiasm. So 10 years earlier, it had been VLSI, etc. So he told me about the FPGA, and I thought, I don't like hardware, etc. So needless to say, I had to write all my own tools in order to use FPGAs, and that turned out to be my subsequent life, leaving 5 years ago to join Xilinx, the worldwide leader in FPGAs, etc., in the research labs. And funnily enough, I finally connected the dots since we're doing networking using FPGAs, etc., but I have to say there's no theory particularly in sight there. Meanwhile, I got detoured, I suppose, onto the administrative side rather more than I'd expected, in addition to the technical fun. Maybe it's because the fun element of the technical side was diminishing, etc., so you find some new distraction, and academic politics is just as cerebral as looks at Mike Foreman at this point. And I suppose I suddenly realized one day, probably after another conspiratorial session with Mike in his office in the run-up to informatics, that really I was using all my cycles on some arcane Byzantine academic plots, and I'd had enough of it. So there began my downward curve, I suppose, into sort of civilian life again. And 5 years ago, the opportunity to leave Edinburgh came up, and I think it was about time. I think 27 years when you arrive as an undergraduate is probably a bit much, but I look back fondly at the fun years, basically from when I arrived until sometime circa mid to late 80s, and at the end of the day, we're all having great fun, I think it's fair to say, but it really felt useful at the time, and I think the great work that Graham's doing here is actually recording it before it's too late, because I think there's too many of us that know what was going on, but it didn't get out there. So it's a pleasure to come back and just recall vaguely what it was like for a few minutes. And that's it.